Sanskrit is a blueprint for universal forces, from the stars and the planets to the chakras of the subtle body. But Sanskrit is also a blueprint for relative manifestations, like a tomato, a plant, a collarbone. Sanskrit reflects the vibratory patterns that govern everything in the universe. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I am your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator. I'm also a student of Sanskrit, a student of life, a student of Ayurveda, an internal student. And today we're going to speak about Sanskrit, this sound language, or not even language, this phenomena of sounds, or this collection of sounds and vibratory fields that trigger certain laws of nature, with two wonderful women, Kamala and Janavi, who are very intimate sisters, who are very close to each other, and they've been brought up in India, and they've spent, you know, over 8 years in India, and they've been heavily influenced by yogic philosophy, Indian philosophy, culture, Ayurveda, Vedic astrology, meditation, chanting, have some wonderful experiences which they share. And, you know, they're recording this from Kathmandu in Nepal. And, you know, in this episode, we're hearing quite a bit about their life, because I met them over a decade ago in India, and they've had a fascinating upbringing. But also about what they're heavily focusing on now is the sounds of nature, which we call Sanskrit. And this involves Vedic chanting plus much more. So we're going to dive into this. Before that, if you enjoy what you hear and enjoy what we do at Vital Veda Podcast, please leave a review on your podcast app. You know, subscribe so you didn't miss a show. Check out the other episodes. There's so many awesome episodes. We've been going hard on the Vedic topics recently. Veda is, of course, the laws of nature, the laws that govern everything in nature, which includes meditation, yoga, Ayurveda, Stapatya Veda, Vedic architecture. So it's just so fun. This is actually a bridge from our last episode with Eddie Stern, where we spoke about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali and these cities, these divine human capabilities. And we talk about this as well here. So enjoy the episode and stay tuned to the end, because we announce a pretty special giveaway that you can win, and win some very special Indian art, or sacred art, holy art, vibratory art produced by Janavi. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and much love. Janavi and Kamala, beautiful to see both, or Kamala and Janavi. They're elongated. Vowels at the end. Beautiful to see you guys.
You too.
It's funny. I think once my friend shared with me your Instagram and said, check out these girls, they're really living the Desi life. I recognized them. And then I saw, and then I think you guys messaged me and said, you made the connection, or I don't know, I can't make the connection playing. And it was just like, wow. So we saw each other over 10 years ago in Delhi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Were brought by each other's parents, fortunate enough to be at, you know, at the clinic with Dr. Raju in
Delhi.
So, yeah, we're going to get into that and hear about your story. But first, how we always start a Vital Veda podcast is we ask you, what was your dinacharya this morning?
Ooh.
What was your daily routine? And I'll whoever woke up earlier can start.
It was probably you.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
But I'll leave it with you two. Out of you, whoever woke up early, out of you two.
Okay.
Probably her.
Yeah, it was probably me.
Yeah, my routine was a little off today.
Okay.
Yeah, so usually, I mean, and this goes for both of us, I would say, we wake up and, you know, get that garam pani or that hot water. That's the first thing.
Always start with the hot water.
Yeah. And, of course, meditation is one of the first things that we start our day with. So we meditate twice a day for 20 minutes. And, yeah, that was the first thing I did this morning, was meditate.
Mm-hmm. Anything different with you, Janavi?
Not today. But normally I'd like to fit in some yoga practice as well.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So you guys are now in Kathmandu. And mm-hmm. I mean, you've got American accents, but you were born in England, and I don't know how long you've lived in India. So tell us a bit about, like your growing up, and I don't know where you are today. Just a general overall picture.
Yeah, it's quite a long story, but we'll condense it down a bit. We were both born in England, and Janavi was maybe like 4 months old when we moved to America. And so we spent really like our childhood years in America for about 8 years. Then we moved to Holland. We lived there for 2 years. And then we came to India. We'd been to India before many times, and I'm sure we can talk about our first trip to India later. But we came to India. I was about 12. Janvi was...
I was 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we weren't really expecting, like, we didn't know how long we were going to stay, but then we ended up staying for 6 years without leaving.
Yeah. So once we'd arrived, like, we were there for 6 years nonstop, traveling around, living mostly in Rishikesh. And it was only really, it was in 2014. So after 6 years, I went back to London and did my BA and then went on to do my MPhil. And it was after that that we came back to India and kind of started living in India again. The intention was more to be like between Europe and India, but then of course, with COVID and everything, we actually fortunately were able to stay in India much longer than we anticipated.
Yeah, a whole extra year than we'd planned to.
Yeah. That kind of takes us up to the present.
Yes, and obviously your parents had a big influence because, you know, you were girls still in school and I think homeschooling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My mother, who I spoke to the other day, I told them I'm interviewing you guys and she has more memories of you guys. I mean, she was spend a lot more time at the clinic. And so,
yeah.
I mean, let's go back to the clinic. So we met in a Panchakarma clinic in Delhi with Dr. Raju. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like your father, at least, I remember your father very well, that he was living there. Like, mm-hmm. It seemed like he was living there half the year, or he spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, we were back and forth.
Yeah, we'd go between Delhi and Rishikesh. So sometimes we'd come to Delhi for stuff.
Was he just, you know, hanging out with Dr. Raju, or is he getting treatment so many times of the year, like, because some people hang out at the Panchakarma clinic a lot.
They do, yeah. We used to see that a lot of the same people there. I mean, of course, you guys and your mum as well. Actually, Janvi and I were remembering her today as well.
Yeah. And we met your grandmother.
Yeah, we did. We met your brother as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were back and forth. And, you know, like, my father has known Dr. Raju for so long. And of course, we were friends with his kids for many years. But yeah, we were all like, well, my parents were mostly doing treatment and different things. And eventually we also tried it, a little bit of Panchakarma ourselves.
We were pretty young back then though.
Right? Yeah. 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 But for the most part, we were living in Rishikesh and that was our home base. As you were saying, we actually did our schooling online there, and that was a really fortunate thing because it enabled us to have so much flexibility and freedom while living in India, which I think for a lot of people, especially children, they wouldn't get the chance to, you know, travel whenever or to structure our own routines so that we were able to complete our schoolwork in time to take trips around. And so we were able to see so much of India during those 6 years that, yeah, it's, I mean, looking back on it, it's like, wow, how did we do all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And still so much more to do, of course. But
so when I saw you guys, which was over a decade ago, I mean, okay, I can see that Kamala, definitely you had blonde hair. Did you as well, Janvi? I just remember this really whitish blonde hair.
I think that was her. Yeah. I had really dark hair back then, even more dark than it is now.
Yeah, now we've kind of like leveled out.
The reason I ask is because when you have really blonde hair, and anyway, you guys, I remember having very fair skin, you know.
Yeah.
So in India, you definitely get stood out, especially as a young girl.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I assume, although it's basically like your home, India, and even to me, it is, and I've spent only a fraction of what you guys have spent. You know, I was living there half the year for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
But still, you know, you have this, you know, this, they treat you like a Westerner. Not that it's a bad thing, it's a great thing in many ways, but so just curious about that, you know, how do you deal with that as this is your home, but still people are like, wanting to take photos of you, like I'm sure you guys have had the influx of selfies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very well intentioned and people are very kind. You know, they want to, they want to talk to you. They want to practice English sometimes or they want to take pictures. It's all fine. Like we're used to it. But I think at first, like when I was young, especially for me, I would say, because
I was still a child then. Yeah. So mm-hmm. It was like people were staring at me, not because I was a girl, but just because I was a child. So it was like, less invasive in a way than
what younger. Is your age difference?
I'm 3 years younger than Kamala.
Well, two and a half.
Okay.
Yeah, rounded up. But yeah, for me, I think at first it was a little bit of a challenge. Like I didn't really like going outside that much in the beginning, just because it was quite overwhelming at times. Or at least like once
I feel
you
like
moved
we
back.
Actually had quite different experiences of India, because I was like all about going outside and experiencing everything, and she was like more of a recluse.
Just a bit, but just a little bit. Yeah, I think I just had to get over that, and it's just a small inconvenience, you know, you just have to push past it,
and you just have to work out how to deal with it, like if people are being respectful or if they're disrespectful, how to deal with those situations.
And not to take things too seriously, and to try and, I think for me, like sometimes I do have to be like a little bit less friendly than I'd like to in certain situations.
But also, like, when you connect with people, like, and they realize that you understand their culture more and that you understand their language. And
Speaking Hindi is a good key. Like, that really changes the vibe.
Then they get a little bit, like, the people that are being disrespectful, they are a bit more apologetic.
For sure, there's so much respect and awe. You know, they love, especially traditional Indians or from the lower classes who are unfamiliar with the West, they just are so grateful to see someone, you know, re-enlivening the Vedic culture and appreciating it. And one thing, just on that note, just for any people wondering, traveling to India may be a bit scared. One thing I recommend to women in general is wear a silver toe ring on your second toe, on each of your second toe when you're walking around. That's why that indicates that you're married and you're probably getting less bugged by men.
It might work. Yeah, Janvi often wears the toe.
Yeah, but I don't actually wear it for that reason. I just think it.
It's a great thing. I've had friends who taught me that, and my friends were women, and they found it helpful. So how, I'd just like to say again, like, you're living, you obviously have a very intimate sister relationship. I mean, you guys have started, you know, essentially a business together. Mm-hmm. You're always together. So, you know, definitely people come across siblings like that, and it is rare, you know. I have two siblings and I'm close with them, but I don't, you know, you come across these siblings who are really like intimate and together all the time. So I don't know, tell us how that feels for you. I've never experienced it. Although I have two siblings, so and particularly growing up in India, where I assume there wasn't, you know, you didn't have, you know, you homeschooled, so the friends you have are limited growing up.
Well, I would say that it kind of happened just organically due to the fact that we were traveling so much. Even before moving to India, our family had always traveled a lot. And so we always had those shared experiences and such a unique upbringing as well.
Yeah. So even though we had other friends, we always connected back with our shared experiences. Like when you go to like a public school or something and you have all of these friends that have very similar experiences to you, but with us it was just each other that have all the like similar experiences. So we'd always connect because of that.
And I think also that it's because of, you know, it's a culmination of all of these experiences that we were able to start Samadhi together, just because we know that we work well together, we know that we have a similar understanding of these, you know, topics and Indian philosophy and all of these things that we've been studying and learning throughout our lives. And so in a way, this like unique sister relationship led us into what we now do like day to day. And it's brought us closer, but in a different way, because we realize how our skills complement each other. And we actually have very different interests, even though it seems like we're focusing on the same thing. And so we can see that
we had like very different paths, like for a few years, like we were very interested in different things. But then during lockdown, or like when we were in India, then they kind of got brought together again, because we realized how they could complement each other, the skills that we'd been.
And it's also definitely an India thing, because when we were living in the West for the last five, well, not the last 5 years, but when we were during my university and all, we had very different friend groups and different paths, and we weren't spending that much time together. So I feel like also that time of being away from each other for 5 years kind of made us realize what we have is so unique, and our connection and just everything we've been through together, which is a lot of different things. Just
it's beautiful. Tell us about Samadhi Collective.
Sure. Yeah, so we started Samadhi, it's been a year now, I would say about a year,
a bit over a year now.
And so it's really a community, a platform, an online space where we share on mantra, Sanskrit, yoga, Indian philosophy, I said Sanskrit already, I think. Yeah. Music, art, yeah. Everything inspired by ancient philosophies and spiritual practices from India.
Beautiful. And I'm going to have to now pick your brain, Kamala, because I've just started studying Sanskrit. And it's been long overdue, and I always knew I would study. When I first started studying Ayurveda with the Rajus, one of the very initial things they said is you should study Sanskrit. So they invited someone to teach me Hindi to learn Devanagari and all these things first.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, this was like in my early years. I was like, why would I be spending my time here when I could be studying Ayurveda? So I kind of put it aside, and now I'm at it earlier than I thought, because one of the Rajus, Harsha Raju, recommended to me. He said you should really learn. When I was telling him how much I love Sanskrit and shlokas, although I can't read or write it, but I love it. And he's like, yeah. Well, you should really study it so you understand each intricate sound on a deeper level.
Absolutely.
So I've studied with maybe, you know, Antonia Ruppel from, she wrote Cambridge Introduction to Sanskrit at Cambridge Uni. And for me, I did 1 year of university and I dropped out because I just could not stand university and systems. I'm not that kind of guy. So I loved your experience studying at Oxford. You know, like
the opposite end of the spectrum.
Exactly. And the other end of the spectrum to India and like learning chanting and also what about Oxford? And then what about, I don't know, did you study else in India? Yeah. Ashrams, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first of all, I did my BA in history of art, and that was kind of where it all started. I was living in London. I was studying Indian art for one of my modules, and I was doing my thesis on Ragmala painting, which is these paintings that are based on modes of Indian classical music. And so Janvi and I had studied Indian classical vocal music for many years growing up. So it was that music interest that led me to study these paintings. These paintings had inscriptions in the Devanagari. And so I was thinking, you know, I'm really interested in this text-image relationship and expanding on my art history knowledge and all of these things through the language that a lot of these texts are written in, which is Sanskrit. And so I went to do my Master of Philosophy in Indian Philosophy and Sanskrit at Oxford. A lot of studying the last 5 years. It was quite intense, of course, but I had really amazing professors, and everything it's taught in a very systematic way. It's very in-depth. But of course, we're learning it from an academic perspective in Oxford, which is not exactly how it would be taught in the traditional context. And so during my vacations, in each vacation, I would come to South India, to Karnataka, and I was studying in a traditional school there with a pundit, and he was teaching me all of the traditional ways that they would recite and learn these Sanskrit, you know, the grammar and everything. And so I really, I'm very grateful to have had that balance between the tradition of learning Sanskrit and the academic Western perspective, because I think that really, it gives me a very unique understanding of the language. But advice for you and in general for learning Sanskrit, really the most important thing, and this sounds almost reductive in a way, but the most important thing is to not try and learn. You know, like when we think of studying in a Western context, we're thinking of, you know, how can I memorize this sheet of words, or how can I memorize this paradigm? And it's like you repeat it over and over and you're focusing, you're like, how can I learn this? But really, it's the moment when you let go of trying to learn it that it just assimilates itself into your mind. And the traditional way that the grammatical like paradigms are learned in Sanskrit is just through repetition, and like it's sort of a rote chanting, you could even say, of words and everything. And when you're doing that, you don't have to try and learn because it just happens. So that's kind of that's one thing. But then at the same time, when it comes to Sanskrit, really the most important thing is the pronunciation of the sounds, because Sanskrit is a spoken language. It has an oral tradition that was passed down through generations. So it wasn't written down until maybe even a couple thousand years after the sounds were said to be cognized by the ancient seers. So this language is based on the sounds. It's based on the pronunciation of sounds. And when we read and write in Sanskrit, it's actually, so the scripts that we use are not Sanskrit. So Devanagari is the most commonly used script. And it is a script. It's a vehicle to convey the sounds, basically. And so we can write Sanskrit in a variety of different scripts. There's many regional scripts used, you know, from Bengal to Gujarat to some of the Dravidian languages and scripts, or scripts rather. And so Sanskrit refers to the sounds, not the scripts. And that's just something that I think a lot of people don't realize. And there's a lot of emphasis on the written aspect of it, but the sounds are what is most important.
Yeah, beautiful. And that's what I started with, just hearing, you know, the words that my teacher would say. And I just love how onomatopoeic they are. The whole Sanskrit language is onomatopoeic. It's the sound of what nature's intending to portray.
Absolutely.
And it can be as subtle. Most of them can be very subtle. And even they can be as gross as, like, my favorite example is Hridya. Hridya is the name of the heart. The whole thing is onomatopoeic. And yeah, I'd love to hear more about, because I've battled this, that academic perspective. I mean, in my class, there's about 200 people and half of them are yogis like me, you could say, or studying it. And then the other half are linguistics and they're just like on a whole other level and they're going high. I've never studied a language before. I didn't even know English. How much do I realize I don't know English? Never learned about these case forms of nouns and these different ways to portray a verb. And
I know, it's something else.
So it's been, this is good because I think a lot of people listening are into the Vedas, into yoga, and, you know, why should they consider Sanskrit? And elaborate more on good ways to approach it.
Absolutely. I think Janvi can definitely speak to the yoga perspective.
Yeah.
But I think one thing I will say is that, you know, today especially, there's so much interest in these various fields like Sanskrit and Ayurveda and, you know, Jyotish, all of these different fields, and the terminology that we use in these different practices. And it's really beneficial to study the language and to learn the language so that we can have our own understanding and our own connection to these fields or whatever our focus is and our interest.
Yeah.
And yeah, with yoga.
Even with yoga names, like just learning the correct pronunciation of yoga names is super beneficial for your yoga
asana
practice and your teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah, asana means, sorry.
I totally feel that. Like in yoga and in Ayurveda and any of these Vedic sciences, we're studying, you know, whatever we're studying or enlivening through an yoga asana or through, you know, prescribing a food protocol or a herb. Like when we learn the Sanskrit sound, there's so much power in that sound because sound is really the initial manifestation of that. So if we're describing a yoga asana, and like I saw you guys do a post on Instagram, a friend shared with me of, you know, the way to pronounce chakra. And like maybe you, like, because we're talking about these chakras rather than chakra, like not these seven chakras, but these chakras. And I'll get you to pronounce it a bit because I'm sure you'll pronounce better. But like they're such powerful bundles of nerves in your body, which connects you to these divine realms. And when you even just say it, or even don't have to say it out loud, you just know the sound of that. That enlivens it within you.
And also, like, you know, obviously everyone has different accents, you know, people from all over the world, different countries and studying and everything. But really, you know, the reason why we stress the pronunciation so much, especially in our sessions and teaching, and that's one of the main focuses in our Sanskrit sessions and mantra chanting as well, is because that unlocks the vibration of the word, you know?
The word is the, like,
sound.
Yeah, it's the actual meaning. Like you can feel the meaning of the word when saying it, you know what I mean?
That's beautiful. And you guys you guys chant mantras and it's powerful. Like, I mean, if you didn't see you guys, you'd probably think you're one of those Indian women who chant. It's usually you see men chanting and pundits, but occasionally if you look up on YouTube or whatever, you'll see like chants by women. And and so I'd love to talk about chanting and mantra because as I've been taught by the Raju family, who are my teachers, Ayurveda, and I assume similar teachings to Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, who is also your lineage, right? So I believe what they said is to not chant mantras out loud, or at least that's what I've been taught, to always an emphasis on chanting should be done inwardly.
Right.
However, there's some exceptions, like in a group, like for example, kirtan.
Right.
So I'd love to get your guys' view on that and or perhaps appropriate utilization of mantra.
Yeah, definitely.
It really depends on the mantra. Like if it's your Guru Diksha, then that might be a mantra that you're supposed to recite silently to yourself. And like Gayatri mantra, you're only supposed to be reciting that quietly. But then there's other mantras which the specification is to recite it aloud.
Mm. Yeah. And also it's important to note that the mantras that we're sharing are those which are appropriate to be recited by anyone. So there are certain mantras which are, you know, it requires initiation into a particular lineage to be able to recite them. Or as you were mentioning, you know, quite often we mostly see men or pundits reciting mantras. And so, you know, the Vedas and Vedic mantras are mostly considered appropriate only for pundits to recite, those who've been trained in these traditions. And so we're really conscious of which mantras we are sharing and, you know, what is appropriate to share and what is available to be learned or studied by anyone, regardless of their background, their culture, their country, you know.
Yeah, just staying really respectful to the tradition.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really beautiful. Who do you look for guidance when you're, you know, for example, I'm teaching, I don't know if I should teach this mantra to my new online class?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we've been so fortunate because throughout the years, we've had so many amazing teachers, both men and women, of course, and they have just each time we would have a new teacher or another person would come into our lives and teach us something new, we were just able to assimilate the knowledge from all of our teachers together. And it's, yeah, we're just really fortunate that we're able to share it with a wider audience or with people around the world as well, and just to spread what we've learned. And yeah,
but we only share the things that we know for sure are
yeah
good to share.
Absolutely. Yeah. We would check with our teachers what is appropriate
if
to share.
If we had any question, then of course we'd check with one of our many teachers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. What type of mantras are you sharing? You don't have to share the whole mantra, like chant it, but
yeah.
Just, you know, you mentioned before. It's interesting to hear Gayatri.
We have done that before on a podcast.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I would love to do it at some point, but
yeah,
like it's a very interesting. I never heard that. Like Gayatri is more of an inward one, whether, you know, it's common to go through. I mean, what about for example, Gayatri mantra, which I reckon a lot of people know it, but don't know it by the name. So, do you guys want to give a little? Oh, but it should be chanted inwardly. So
that's the thing. Yeah.
So this is interesting. So. Yeah, have a go on that.
If they search it, if they look it up, they'll find it for sure. Okay, because it's a very popular one. But there are a lot of mantras, specifically, you know, those which are taught in these yoga teacher trainings. And there are certain mantras that a lot of people are very familiarized with. But really, in our recent course, it's called Mantra, the Sound of Yoga. So we picked 10 mantras, you know, some of our favorite mantras, some which many people know from yoga teacher trainings. And we were really focusing on correct Sanskrit pronunciation. That's really the main focus. And to help people refine their pronunciation if they've already been chanting these mantras. And if they're new to it, to, you know, give them that foundation to build on and just really, yeah, explain correct pronunciation, show how to pronounce the mantras through the practical application of chanting, basically.
Beautiful. But, you know, when I started learning Sanskrit, I had to stop and learn the alphabet. Like I had to stop this course and go to like Duolingo, which is an app which teaches you language and learn Hindi. And
yeah.
My friend who learnt with you, her name is Prema, I'm sure she'll listen to this. And she was just saying how she loved how you guys took a lot of time to learn the alphabet. Because, you know, if you're learning a new script, you definitely need to take time. So I love those foundations that you're establishing.
Yeah. Now that's the sounds and scripts of Sanskrit. So really those 7 sessions are focused on learning the correct pronunciation of the alphabet and then learning to read and write in the Devanagari script, which as I mentioned earlier is the most commonly used script for Sanskrit. But then we also focus on IAST, which is the international alphabet of Sanskrit transliteration. And so this alphabet enables you to write Sanskrit words in Roman script using diacritic. And so in this way, we're able to preserve the correct pronunciation of the sound. And so that is a really useful tool because you do see a lot of discrepancies. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, what was I going to say?
I don't know.
I was just saying that a lot of books and stuff, they have the transliteration. So that's also a helpful tool to recite the mantras correctly. Tend to always read the Devanagari, even if you know it. Like you might end up just reading the English. So at least if you read the transliteration, you'll still be getting that correct pronunciation.
Yeah, definitely.
And even we can take the example of chakra, as we were speaking about earlier. So typically we see chakra spelt C-H, you know, but in IS transliterations, it's actually C-A. And because this cha sound, C-A, written C-A, is an aspirated sound. Whereas if we would write C-H, that would be cha, an aspirated sound. And so it's these little distinctions and, you know, these subtleties that really enable us to refine our pronunciation. And yeah,
I think that's a really good point you have. I don't want to go on it too much because like a lot of people aren't studying Sanskrit, but it's that, for example, chakra. Like if I'm trying to portray it to an English audience, whether you're writing a post on Instagram, like, what do you write? Do you write C-H-A or do you stay true to it and write C-A? Because then you get people pronouncing it kakra, like, or sakra. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I know.
I've experienced that before.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear, I mean, guys obviously have a very intimate relationship with India.
Mm.
So I also do. So I just would love to hear, you know, what are your favorite parts of India or your favorite places to go?
Yeah.
Some that come to mind.
There's so many places, but Rishikesh, I have a very strong connection to, and I always, like, I'd be happy to just live in Rishikesh even now, like, put my roots down there. But there's many places across India that are really special. Like, I really like Karnataka as well.
Mm.
I studied yoga there and I had some really beautiful experiences there. So it's somewhere that I feel drawn to.
Yeah, tell us about experiences. Any specific places in these cities or, you know, for me, it's temples or certain places in nature.
I have a really specific one I was thinking, which is Bhubaneswar in Orissa. Just because that's a place that not many people visit. It's not really a typical tourist destination, but it's just so beautiful. And you were mentioning temples. It's like every street has a temple. You could just look to, you know, you're walking down the road and you look over and there's like a tiny little temple, like down an alley.
And the architecture of the temples is very unique to the area as well.
And it's just such a beautiful place to visit. There's also the Konark Sun Temple. It's one of, you know, I think it's two or three sun temples in India.
One of them is right next to where we were in lockdown as well.
Yeah.
In the mountains.
In the Kumaon region.
That's also a really special place.
Yeah. Kasar Devi is a village where we spent 8 months during 2020, during the lockdown. And it was there that we actually started Samadhi. So that place has a very special significance to us.
And also it's one of like three places in the world that have this specific,
oh yeah, and we read somewhere it's like a vortex energy or something, these like certain coordinates or points on Earth where there's like a channel of energy or something. We don't know too much about it, but apparently Kasar Devi is one of three places in the world,
and you can feel that when you're there.
Sure. Yeah, it's got a very strong energy. And the other two,
where is it?
It's near Almora, which is in Uttarakhand, so it's in the same state as Rishikesh, but higher up in the mountains.
There's
really
also
beautiful
temple there as well called the Jageshwar Mandir.
Yeah.
And that's a really powerful temple. It's like a collection.
Where from Rishikesh? Which direction?
Well, it's more north. Yeah. It's just higher up in the mountains. But also it's hard to explain the geography of it because you'd have to like drive down and then drive up. It's like a different branch.
Yeah.
But
it's quite a wild drive.
Definitely.
But it's worth it.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Absolutely. So yeah, we were lucky to be there during lockdown and being in nature, being around this like mountain landscape and just getting inspired really, and like feeding off each other's ideas and just creating tons of things.
Beautiful. And what are your future intentions for, you know, creating Samadhi and being in India?
That's a good question.
Yeah, good question.
Well, short term, we definitely have more courses in mind we'll be releasing.
Yeah, and also artwork, like Janvi's art. We've released one print of her original Patanjali design, which is like a silk screen print. And we've definitely had requests to create more, you know, of these limited edition pieces. So we're really looking forward to doing that.
On that note, we have Kamala and Janvi have been very kind, especially Janavi, has created to offer a giveaway of one of these silk screen prints of Patanjali.
Yeah.
To you as a listener, potentially, mm-hmm. and the way, you know, tune into the end, I'll share how you can enter the competition to win it. So tell us about Patanjali. We just, there's so much alignments right now, because right now when we're recording this, in 2 days, it's a festival called Naga Panchami, which part of the year where we celebrate snake consciousness. Yeah. Snake is everything to do with Kundalini and Shakti and this serpent energy, which gives us. And on the Vital Veda podcast, if you just tune maybe one or two episodes back, you'll see a podcast we did with Eddie Stone on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, where we talk about these divine human capabilities, which were cognized by this Maharishi Patanjali and who you've portrayed in a piece of art, which you can win if you in competition. So tell us about your relationship with Patanjali, I mean, his teaching.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's kind of where our teaching started.
Yeah.
With Samadhi, because
our first offering on Samadhi was Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, after we'd been requested like many times to share that knowledge.
So. Yeah, we'd learned how to chant the Yoga Sutras in Varanasi.
Wow.
And with a really knowledgeable and amazing teacher. And she taught us all four chapters how to recite. And so that's what we started with. We were sharing the Samadhi Pada, which is very relevant as well to Samadhi Collective.
And that was a coincidence. We did not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. so many coincidences here. But yeah, we were really inspired by chanting the Yoga Sutras. And that's, again, as we were mentioning Dhanacharya earlier, that is something that we practice every day. We chant the Yoga Sutras. And so, yeah, it's had a very big impact in our lives, just reciting these mantras, studying. And
also, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras have such a significance to the yoga community. Everyone, if you've taken a yoga teacher training, you'll know at least a few Yoga Sutras, like Atha Yoga and Anushasanam. There's always a few that people know, but no one learns to recite them. So we thought that would be a very nice offering to share that knowledge of being able to recite the sounds of the Yoga Sutras, which really contain the power.
Yeah, because the word sutra, I mean, it has this connotation of an aphorism or a short verse, but sutra really means to stitch. And so it said, like, when we're reciting these sutras, we are stitching our individual self to the cosmic self. So this is like a mechanism for, you know, connecting ourselves to that wider universal reality. And so, yeah, sutras, they're very short, but they're very impactful. And I think that was also, you know, it is the inspiration behind the Patanjali design. There is a nice little story which tells how Patanjali came into existence. Would you want to share?
It explains his name as well.
Yeah.
It goes, his mother really wanted a child. And she was praying to God, and she was up looking at the sky. She was like, please, I just want a son. Can you please give me a son? And Pat, which means in Sanskrit to fall, Pat, the snake, fell into her Anjali Mudra, her folded hand. So that's Pat Anjali.
Yeah.
And yeah, the snake became her son, Patanjali. So that's how his name was formed.
Yeah, just different expressions of Patanjali, but, you know, some say half man, half snake.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It said, part of the story said that he fell into her hands as a full snake, and then his, like, half, he became half snake, half man.
Yeah, it was just a snake, but then it turned into her.
But there's a lot of stories, because also Patanjali has different incarnations. Like, there's the understanding that Patanjali is the author of a text on grammar, a text on Ayurveda, which I'm sure you know about. And also the Yoga Sutras. So there's also in scholarship, you know, this question of whether this is one Patanjali or three Patanjalis.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, even the mantra, if you're familiar with it's often referred to as the Yogasana mantra or the Patanjali invocation mantra. Maybe we can recite it and then you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do it.
So,
Yogena Chittasya Padena Vacham. Malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarotam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjalir anatosmi.
Beautiful.
So in this mantra, there's a reference to each of the three Patanjalis and contained in one mantra. So we can really understand that whether they are three different people or one, it doesn't really matter. This idea of Patanjali as this teacher and sharing wisdom in so many different fields, yeah, that's all we need to know.
Yes. So but for those who don't know about these Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, like, definitely listen to the podcast with Eddie Stern on Siddhis. On, you know, they're basically these dormant, non-local potentials that exist in every consciousness. Mm-hmm. And as you said, these sutras, they can also, it's where the sutra comes from, sutra, mm-hmm. like a thread. And it's almost like thread. It's like the formula of yoga. The formula of unity is like threading all these mm-hmm. different aspects mm-hmm. together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
even the word sutra is like the English word suture.
That's what the word I was looking for.
yeah. So there's also, it's so interesting to see parallels between languages. Like Sanskrit as an Indo-European language has, anyway, I'm going on a tangent.
No, this is one of my favorite topics. I'd love to hear some of your favorite Sanskrit-Indian correlations, because I love hearing an English word that's derived from Sanskrit.
Yeah. Well, I have to think of some now. That was a really good example I had right off the top of my head. But also, it's really interesting to note that Sanskrit has impacted, you know, languages as far as Europe, because we especially see with the Baltic languages, so countries such as Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, these languages, in their vocabulary and grammar, they have such amazing similarities to Sanskrit. And I was studying with someone from Latvia, and he would say something in Latvian, and he would say, you could translate this into English using your knowledge of Sanskrit. And so it's really amazing to see that, yeah, that there really is a connection between so many languages.
We quite often are like speaking, we're like, wait a second, that word sounds like this word in Sanskrit.
Yeah.
We should have brought more examples.
Yeah. I can't think of anything now, but it happens all the time.
There's so many. Okay, so just on that chanting, like, that was so beautiful. I'd love to, let's talk about chanting, because you teach chanting for a good reason, because that was so beautiful. And tell us about your experience with chanting. And just, of course, which was, for me, the utmost noticeable was this divine harmony of resonance between you two. And I know that's kind of like the goal of chanting, or like a common shared experience in chanting of having this divine resonance. But clearly for you two, like intimate sisters that you are, this was something something else.
Yeah.
So tell us about, why would someone want to learn chanting? Why is chanting? And we also did a podcast with Raghunath Kapo about kirtan and chanting. It's kind of different. Like, it's, I mean, similar, definitely. It's chanting mantras with music. But this is a different type of chanting. So yeah, give us an experience of this as a practice.
I feel like our chanting started not with chanting, but with our singing.
Yeah.
Because we studied Hindustani classical singing for so many years.
Yeah.
When we were growing up. And yeah, that also gave us this connection between each other with our voices.
Yeah, absolutely. And through that as well, we were learning, you know, these traditional ragas and also mantras. But, you know, we would sometimes practice certain mantras and put them into a certain raga. So for those who are listening who are not familiar, a raga is an arrangement of notes. So there's seven notes in Hindustani classical music, and they're arranged on different scales. And each of these ragas has...
What are the seven notes? Yeah,
exactly. Oh, sa, re, ga, ma, pa, da, ni, sa.
Like do, re, mi, but sounds great.
yeah. And so these notes, you know, certain notes are arranged, and that forms a raga. And each raga has a specific time of day that it is most appropriate to listen to or to sing, and creates a certain mood, or is performed in a certain season, a certain time of year.
They even have health benefits
for them as well. Also in Ayurveda, there's a lot of relevance, because each raga is good for certain things. So we'll sing a raga, it will lower your blood pressure, whereas another raga will, you know, like that.
I just have to butt in, because literally the other day I was doing a phone consultation with Dr. Raju and a patient, which I regularly do, a kind of three-way consultation.
Yeah.
And this woman was in hospital with high blood pressure, and he only gave one herb, but it wasn't mainly the herb. The main treatment was listening to this specific chanting. And that was the main treatment, literally. And he said that will change a lot.
Wonderful example.
Yeah. And that also, like, the benefits of raga, I mean, it doesn't stop there. Of course, mantras as well. The intention or the qualities of different mantras really have different positive benefits. So, you know, we recite certain mantras for certain situations. So for example, Ganesha mantra, we would recite to remove obstacles because Ganesha is the deity of removal of obstacles.
Yeah, but it goes deeper than that because it's the power of the sounds that creates that ability to remove the obstacle. Mm.
Yeah. And even for those who don't resonate so much with, you know, anthropomorphic deity figures or, I don't know, in that way, you know, you can also understand it on a level of energy or intention and just, you know, the sounds having just a sonic resonance that conveys that feeling or gives that intention that you set into it. So we can understand it on multiple levels of interpretation based on, you know, what resonates with us and what feels good in terms of how we want to chant. So, yeah.
So important. And that's another reason to learn to pronounce it, because, you know, these, you can utilize these sounds to trigger certain laws of nature. The power of mantra.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I mean, if people are interested in joining some of our sessions, we have a summer sessions going on right now, which is we've made a few of our courses available as a sort of self-paced, downloadable. Yeah, so if you are interested, we have Sounds and Scripts of Sanskrit, so 7 sessions for learning to pronounce the sounds and read and write in Devanagari. And we have Patanjali Yoga Sutras, the Samadhipada, if you'd like to learn to chant that. And then also Mantra, the Sound of Yoga. So those 10 mantras that we were speaking about earlier. So these 3 courses, I'm mentioning it because, yeah, we have these like special bundles available for the next 4 days. So if anyone's interested, okay. Yeah.
But 4 days will be, we won't release this till then.
Oh, well, then don't worry anyway, about it. But in future.
Your website?
Yeah, our website is samadhicollective.com. And our Instagram is samadhi.collective.
Cool. And I just remembered a question I had. Have you learnt these yoga sutras of Patanjali off by heart? Or you read the text
and
you chant? Yeah, wow.
We know them off by heart. Wow. Yeah. And again, as we bringing it back to what you were saying before, anyway.
The memorization.
Yeah, the memorization when you're not trying to learn, you just keep repeating it. And then we never tried to learn the yoga sutras off by heart. It just happened because we were doing it every day. Yeah. And so that's a really important takeaway. Like
when we were trying to memorize them, it was really, really hard. Mm. As soon as we gave up, that's when it came to us and stuck in our minds.
I mean, it's different to, that's chanting, which, you know, I've also memorized shlokas, but now I'm trying to read Sanskrit primarily for the focus, well, yes, to understand the greater diversity of the nature of the sounds, but also to be able to read texts.
Yeah.
And for that, I find, I don't know, this academic approach, which, I don't know, is not my style. I'll figure my own way.
And, really.
Yeah. With Sanskrit especially, like, you studied it for 5 years. Like, I know people who've been studying it for, like, over 10 years. Like, it's not like a language you learn and you can speak and it's finished. Yeah. Like, what is this endless study academica?
Yeah, actually, we learned, like, how to read and write Devanagari when we were kids. Like from a very young age. But it was only 2 years that I studied it in for my master's. And so it was really condensed in, you know, you're learning all of the grammar, you're translating texts as soon as you can, basically. And just having that continual exposure and really, really just having to work everything out in such a condensed space of time, it's the best way to learn Sanskrit, like honestly. You really have to discipline yourself into it and to make sure that you're doing a little bit every day. That is the key.
Yeah, I've been doing that. And it's funny, I told Dr. Raj the other day that I've been studying for, I don't know, at least the third or fourth time that I've told him, but kind of only registered then. And he goes to me, oh, first thing he said to me was, very good for your brain, like very good for the neurological health. That was the first thing you said.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so true.
My professor's always talking about that. He's like, I wonder when the neuroscientists study this aspect of Sanskrit and like.
Yeah.
But you can feel the benefit for your brain.
Absolutely.
After reciting something or
pronouncing the sounds.
Learning some, like when you're learning Sanskrit, it feels like a workout for your brain. For sure.
Let alone mantras. Yeah.
It reminds me of the feeling of when you are working out a math equation and like, you know, once you get the answer, that feeling, or when you're playing the piano and you learn, like you master a song, it's the same kind of feeling. It's like all of the parts are kind of coming together and it all is working. That's what it feels like.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, guys. So I think we should end with a mantra of your choice. If you guys would be so kind.
Sure. Absolutely. Maybe we will end with
I was thinking even the Yoga Sutras we could recite.
Yeah, we could recite a little bit from the Samadhipada. That would.
Okay. And Samadhipada, is there any particular flavor of the Samadhipada? I mean, the aspect of Samadhi. Will you explain what is Samadhi and what is that
pada? Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question.
Yeah, that's a great question.
So Samadhi is, according to the Yoga Sutras and Yoga philosophy of Patanjali, Samadhi is this state of equilibrium, of pure consciousness. It is the eighth limb. So it is the culmination of these yogic practices. And the state of Samadhi is really when you are at your true innate self. You could say your Svabhava, which is your innate state of being. That's one of our favorite Sanskrit words, Svabhava.
Yeah. I was having like a long discussion about the word Svabhava the other day.
Can you break it up?
So Sva means oneself or own, and then Bhava is being, existing. And so when we put Sva and Bhava together, Svabhava is own state of being, one's own true state of being.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, yeah. I think one of the one of the words for health in Ayurveda is Svastha, you know, Svastha or Svastha.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of controversial of how do you pronounce it, if you pronounce it wa or va.
Right, but
Svastha, and it essentially means established in self, and that's the definition of health. It's Svastha. Well, that's the word for health.
Yeah,
which makes beautiful. So much sense.
Yeah.
It really does.
Give us
some
Samadhi.
Okay.
Serenade us with some Samadhi.
You'll have to. We'll just do a few verses because we could go on for the whole chapter and that would take a little time. So we'll just do a few. Okay.
Tatamodhyaya Samadhipadaha Atta Yoganushasanam Yogaschitta Vritti Nirodaha Tadadrashto Svarupe Vasthanam Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra Vrittaya Panchataya Klishta Klishtaha Pramana Viparyaya Vikalpa Nidra Smritayaha Pratyakshanumana Agamaha Pramanani Viparyayo Mityagyanam Atadrupa Pratishtam Shabdagyana Anupati Vastu Shunyo Vikalpaha Abhava Pratyaya Lambana Vritir Nidra Anubhuta Vishaya Sampramosha Smritihi Abhyasa Vairagya Abhyam Tannirodaha Tatrastitau Yatno Vyasaha Satu Dhirga Kala Nairantarya Satkara Sevito Dhrida Bhumihi Drashtanu Shavika Vishaya Vitrishnasya Vashikara Sangya Vairagyam Tatparam Purushakyatir Gunavaitrishnyam.
Jai Gurudev.
So these are the first 16 sutras that we just recited. And yeah, it's hard to stop us once we start. We just keep going.
I could listen for a long time. Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for joining. So yeah, check out Samadhi Collective on the internet, on Instagram. Check out one of those courses. If you ever wanted to learn Sanskrit, I highly recommend it because, you know, like what I did, I studied this very linguistic university approach. It was just full on. So good to like really understand the sounds and break it up at a foundational level. Get your foundations when you're studying something. And what a beautiful way to dive deeper into the Vedas than to understand these language of sound. So for the competition, which I'm excited to share, as we mentioned, Janavi's so generous to share this beautiful art that she made of Patanjali, of the half snake, half man. So to enter the competition, this is what you got to do. Share this episode on Instagram story and tag us both. and give us your takeaway. Write your takeaway. What's one thing that you took away? And also in the Instagram post associated with this video, you can comment. Comment one takeaway, right? So share this one thing, share it on Instagram, like us both on Instagram, follow us both, sorry. And the third thing is comment on one takeaway. Now, if you don't have Instagram, that's fine. I totally respect you. This other thing you can do, and even if you are part of Instagram, you want to enter a second time, you want to have a second entry, you can leave a review on podcasts and screenshot it and send it to info@vitalveda.com.au. So leave a review on iTunes, write your takeaway from this episode, or just review it. And also, if you want to review the Vital Veda podcast in general, screenshot it, send it to us. That will also count as an entry. And we're going to pick the winner of at random at the end. So we'll pick it up about 14 days after this podcast has been released. And you'll have 14 days to enter this competition and win. So that's it. You know what to do. Check out the show notes for this podcast, as with all our podcasts, vitalveda.com.au/learn/podcast, or just on the website, go to learn and podcast. And we have quite extensive show notes for every episode. As a matter of fact, good old Pedro, who does our show notes, is really pumping them recently. And he in fact, sometimes creates more detail and more knowledge of and elaborates on things that we talk about. So check those out. You'll also have all the instructions to learn about that. So until next time, my friend, much, much love, and may you be in samadhi.
Oh.